This is London Calling.
Hi, I'm Graham Mack. Welcome to the programme and part two of my chat with broadcasting legend Tony Prince. Tony was known all over Europe for his radio work, but he started out in television. He hosted a pop music show and the guests reads like a who's who of the British invasion. And after the shows, he'd jam with them on stage too.
And we'd go to the club afterwards next door, Arnas Court Country Club, and we'd take over the band. You know, you've got Jimi Hendrix on guitar, you know, it's just absolutely amazing.
You've literally got Jimi Hendrix on guitar.
Yeah.
Someone who fancies his chances.
Jimi himself, yeah. He was managed by a mate of mine who was in the Animals, Chas Chandler, bass player with the Animals. He'd be there as well playing bass, you know. And, Jerry Marsden from Jerry Bass playing lead guitar, you know. It was just a hodgepodge of musicians wanting to jam on stage and sing a bit of rock and roll, you know, and you'd have Dusty Springfield and Marianne Faithfull sitting in the audience clapping you, you know. So it was a wonderful, wonderful time to be a part of the 60s.
More from Tony Prince later, but right now let's check in with Joe, who sent me an email. He listens in Chicago.
How you doing today, buddy?
Very good.
Hey, dude, I wonder if you can do me a big favor.
Uh-huh.
I'm about to take my son to school, and we listen to your show.
Okay.
And today's his sixth birthday.
Six?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So if you could wish him a happy birthday, that would be amazing.
Okay. So, well, I need some more details. So he's six today.
Yep.
And what's his name?
Noah. Noah Brown.
Noah Brown is six today. Tell me something about Noah.
Something about Noah.
Yeah.
What do I say about Noah? He's just a great kid, man. He's everything you want in a son.
Yeah.
He loves going to school, which he didn't get that from me.
Yeah.
He loves riding his scooter.
Yeah.
He loves hanging out with his cousins, Zach and Sam.
Yeah. I think I'm there. I think I can do something. Let's see if I can do this. Today is Noah's birthday. I got the word from Joe. Today is Noah's birthday. He told me all I need to know. Today is Noah's birthday. Happy birthday, Noah. You're 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. Yes, we're going to a party. Yes, we're going to a party. Yeah. Happy birthday, Noah!
That's awesome, Graham.
Is Boris Johnson a backseat driver? Now, Boris is the Foreign Secretary. You've probably seen him. He's got a shock of blonde hair. He looks like he's got the same barber as Donald Trump. Well, Brexit negotiations have been a mess. Nothing's been agreed. It's been over a year now. And Boris, as Foreign Secretary, has listed his plans for Brexit in one of our national newspapers. This has led to accusations of him being a backseat driver. A lot of people are calling for Theresa May, the Prime Minister, to sack Boris over this because it shows disloyalty. It's Theresa May that should be setting out a plan for Brexit. Thing is, though, we haven't got an agreement on anything yet on how Britain will look after we leave the EU. And people only become backseat drivers when they've no confidence in the person behind the wheel. I'm Graham Mack, and how's the story of this fella in Manchester? There's a photograph of him online. He's on a train, and he's got his shoes and socks off, and he's got his bare feet on the seat opposite. Hooly dooly. You see some stuff on public transport. What have you seen that really annoys you, Sarah?
Kissing in the morning.
Kissing?
Oh, couples. And like, people who are old enough to know better. Both had a nice night together, what have you. They get on the train, they go their separate ways. and they kiss in the morning. That sound.
So it's not romantic at all for you?
Well, it probably is for other people, but I just think it's disgusting. I haven't had a coffee yet. I haven't had breakfast yet. I do not want to see that, really. And
kissing
it happens a lot.
Oh, does it? Okay. Kissing on public transport. For you, that's it. All right. Sarah, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Cheers. Why is no one calling their baby Nigel anymore? Nigel Farage from the pro-Brexit UK Independence Party was hardly off our television screens in 2016, but in the year of his greatest political triumph, it looks like no one wanted to name their baby after him. Nigel, as a baby name, has been on the brink of extinction in England and Wales for years, and now it's all but disappeared. That's according to the latest Office of National Statistics figures. At most, there were two Nigels born in 2016. The Office of National Statistics doesn't tell us whether it was two, one or zero, but we can say for sure that more people in England and Wales named their child Elvis than Nigel last year because there were three babies named Elvis. Maybe this is because celebrity names do influence baby names. And the difference between Nigel Farage and Elvis Presley is that Elvis is still popular. A two-year-old called Ronnie Watkins has been making the news in Britain lately. In the English county of Kent, his mum took him shopping to their local supermarket, and he got a toilet seat stuck on his head. Lisa, you've had something stuck on you.
I went to one of these Norton Liquor parties.
These what?
And a naughty liquor party.
Okay, so this is, was it an Anne Summers thing or a lingerie thing?
It was so similar to Anne Summers, so it was a bit of fun.
Yes.
So all the girls were all mucking about, as you do at these sorts of places, and one of my friends put a very vulgar, large plastic ring on my finger.
What do you say it was vulgar? It depicted a graphic piece of the anatomy?
Absolutely.
Okay.
And it was quite, I would use the word bulbous.
Okay.
It was huge, but I couldn't get the damn thing off. My finger.
Right.
But it was absolutely horrendous. I'd had a few drinks, everything was great. I didn't even realise until the next morning. The next morning...
Oh, you're still wearing it the next morning?
Yes!
It's an obscene ring.
It certainly is. I had to go to a funeral, Graham.
No!
That's where I had to go.
No!
It certainly was. And it was a very... Well, it was a funeral of somebody in their 80s, you know?
Yes.
Wasn't a family member.
No,
but
still.
It was, I was going there to sort of show my respects, etc. And I had this damn thing. I managed to get it off about an hour before the funeral, but the panic within me was just horrific.
And what
but
was your plan?
Very funny.
What was your plan if you couldn't get it off? Were you going to not go, or were you going to go and put your hand in your pocket or something?
No, I was going to wear a pair of big mittens I found. I remember I found a big pair of mittens.
So there was a plan.
I always have a plan.
All right, Lisa, thanks for sharing. Thank you.
Bye, Graham.
Cheers. Bye. British politicians love telling us that if we vote for them, all of our problems will go away as if by magic. If Labour get into power, they say they'll force credit card companies to write off billions of pounds in debts. The Labour Party are in opposition right now to the ruling Conservative Party. At the Labour Party conference this week, John McDonnell, a shadow chancellor, proposed a cap on the amount of money lenders can charge in interest so that no one has to pay back more than double what they borrowed. He said the policy will help 3 million credit card holders who are trapped by their debt. If this policy comes in, credit card companies would lose up to £1.3 billion a year. That's according to the Financial Conduct Authority. The thing is, if Labour get in, and this proposal becomes law, the credit card companies are not going to miss out on over £1 billion a year. If they don't make as much money from charging feckless people who don't pay back what they owe, they'll just find a way of making money another way, like charging higher fees to the people who do pay up on time and don't pay any interest. And this policy won't reduce household debt. If you cap interest rates, people are going to be more likely to take on credit card debt. This policy, though, it will win votes, because voters would love it if someone had come along and make all of their problems go away by waving a magic wand. Well, professional magicians have a secret. You see, they don't really have magical powers. That's why the things they do in their act are called tricks. Weird stuff you've seen on public transport. Simon.
I think it's fair to say I've seen my fair number of people have a late-night Technicolor yawn. In the cubicles. Once someone may do it in one of the bins in the atrium on the train, this is the King's Cross Cambridge line. But I think the oddest one ever was a chap who, by the looks of it, fell asleep, or possibly passed out drunk in the toilets on a train. You know, this is the booze train, the 10, 11 o'clock one down at King's Cross. You know, some people were wanting to utilise the facilities. So there was some knocking on the door and, like, trying to get the guy to come out. He'd been there a long time. Like, the train had been going, like, nearly 20 minutes. And eventually, the door opens and out comes an extremely leery, extremely loud, rather not southern accented gentleman who was so drunk he could hardly stand. Who then proceeded to tell people where to go, how dare they knock on the toilet and disturb him, and start fisticuffs.
Oh, really? Started a scrap all right there on the track with the people that just wanted to use the toilet? How dare they?
Yep. That made its way halfway down a carriage.
Yeah.
I sort of, with a bunch of colleagues who were getting nervous, sort of pushed some people out of the way and pushed them back again. But then, by the time I think we got to Finsbury Park, because we got on the train early, then there was actually a policeman waiting to have a chat with the gentleman. But yeah, it was the most impressive display of drunk rage. How dare you interrupt my wee? But we're pretty sure he must have fallen asleep, because there was no sound, there was nothing.
It
was dead. We thought he was dead at one point, actually.
It really? Simon, thanks for sharing.
No worries.
Thank you. Britain is known for bad food. In fact, some of it's disgusting. And very confusing if you're American. Piper.
My husband used to work for an American company, and they had some of the guys over from the States. And they all used to have a free breakfast in the canteen. And this chap went in there with him and went, "Oh my God, fantastic chocolate spread!" And then started spreading this sort of stuff all over his toast. And then they just heard this scream from the corner of the canteen, because it wasn't chocolate spread, it was Marmite.
Oh dear, what a shock to the system that would be. Jeez.
I can imagine, yeah.
Yeah. Hey, thank
you
very
much. I can't look at a tub of Marmite without thinking of him and laughing to myself.
Wow, Piper, thank you very much. It'd be an easy mistake to make. I mean, Marmite is a brown paste. It looks like chocolate spread, but it's actually a bitter-tasting, horrible thing made of yeast extract.
Oh,
Where are women in Saudi Arabia going to drive to? By June next year, women will no longer be forbidden from getting behind the wheel of a car. Driving's going to be tricky, though, because by law, women must cover their hair and bodies in public, so visibility could be a problem. If they take the car clothes shopping, getting the right size will be difficult. because women are not allowed to try on clothes in changing rooms. They're not allowed to dress for beauty anyway. Driving to a restaurant will be a waste of time because women are not allowed to eat freely in public. There's no point driving to a newsagent because women are not allowed to read uncensored fashion magazines. Driving to a bank is pointless because Saudi women are not allowed to open a bank account without their husband's permission. In fact, women are not allowed to travel at all without the permission of a male guardian. Giving women in Saudi Arabia the right to drive without giving them these other rights is like giving bicycles to fish. Let's get to my guest, and it's the broadcasting legend Tony Prince. In part one of my chat with him, he talked about growing up in the northwest of England, becoming a singer and a nightclub DJ. That eventually took him to the south of England, where he was spinning the discs in a club in Bristol. Although he became a legend on the radio, he started out in television.
What happened was I was going out with a young beauty queen from Bristol, beauty queen, Heather. And she took me up to this TV show, which had been going a couple of years. It was called Disagogo. And it was a TV show with an audience participating.
So a bit like American Bandstand.
It was a bit like Ready, Steady, Go, only more like The Cavern. They had like arches, and down these arches people danced, and as they moved to one side, there'd be a group at the end of it. The Yardbirds, you know, Sonny and Cher, Barry Maguire, Eve of Destruction, all these guys, you know. So I went up to dance in the audience with her. And when they had a camera break, I sat down in a chair. Heather went off to get a hot dog. And I'm sat there, and suddenly this old guy came up to me and says, "What are you doing in my seat, young fella, me lad?" I said, "It's not your seat. I've been sat here 10 minutes. He said, "Have a look on the back." So I stood up, and there it said, "Director." Right. So I'm looking at the producer of the show, Chris Mercer. And I was very cheeky. I said, "Well, nice to meet you, Mr. Mercer. I've actually come up here to take over from Kent Walton, who was the regular DJ."
Kent Walton, the wrestling.
Yeah, he used to do wrestling commentary, but he was also a Radio Luxembourg DJ. He was Canadian, and he was fronting the show. And he laughed, you know, the producer, he laughed at me and he started talking to me. And I said, "I'm at the top rank in Bristol and I'm a DJ. And I'd love to be involved with the show." So one thing led to another. I'd been moved up to the north of England again, to Leeds in Lancashire, and I got a telegram to call Chris Mercer's secretary in Cardiff. And although the show was in Bristol, their head office was in Cardiff. And I went down to Cardiff to meet him, and I did an audition on the lawn. It was a lovely sunny day. And Millie, who did My Boy Lollipop, was also auditioning, and a little Welsh girl who was very cute was also auditioning. And I did my, he gave me a script, and I read the script. I thought, "I failed here, I don't like reading scripts." He said, "I thought you said you could take over from Kent Walton." I said, "I could do if you didn't have me read a script. Give me somebody to introduce." He said, "Introduce Elvis." Well, that was easy, you know. And I ad-libbed an introduction rather than read from the words. You know, they use auto-cue on the cameras to read everything. And I thought that was so kind of like, you know, straight-laced and too...
It removes you from the audience, doesn't
it? You've got to ad-lib a bit and make a few mistakes, you know, and reading stuff, I just thought... It was the same at the BBC. I went to the BBC Light programme long before I joined Radio Caroline and Luxembourg. I went to the David Jacobs Midday Spin. He was a massive DJ in those days. And he invited me in. He introduced me to his agent. He's trying to help me, you know. And everything he said, he read. And then he took me to Radio Luxembourg studios. He did a show for them as well. And Pete Murray was there and Alan Freeman. These are gods on Radio Luxembourg. And they're all reading scripts, you know. And I couldn't get my head around that, you know. So anyway, my audition for Disagogo worked. I actually got the job and I ad-libbed my way through it. And then I got the job also of helping him to choose the bands and the artists for the show, which was a great thrill. All those, you know, Small Faces, Kinks, all these guys coming down because I'd told him to book them. And yeah, And we go to the club afterwards next door, Arnest Court Country Club, and we'd take over the band. You know, you've got Jimi Hendrix on guitar, you know, it's just absolutely amazing.
You've literally got Jimi Hendrix on guitar.
Yeah, yeah.
You haven't got someone who fancies his chances.
No,
you've got
Jimi
Hendrix.
It was Jimi himself, yeah. He was managed by a mate of mine who was in the Animals, Chas Chandler, bass player with the Animals. He'd be there as well playing bass, you know. And, Jerry Marsden from Jerry Bass was playing lead guitar, you know. It was just a hodgepodge of musicians wanting to jam on stage and sing a bit of rock and roll, you know, and you'd have Dusty Springfield and Marianne Faithfull sitting in the audience clapping you, you know. So it was a wonderful, wonderful time to be a part of the 60s. And then one day in the record library, all these new records came every day. I saw this one and I went up to the producer, to Chris, and I said, Chris, this isn't a great record, but I really would like to meet this guy, and I think you might want to meet him too. He said, why? I said, he's a pirate DJ. Now, we couldn't hear Radio Caroline in Bristol. It was too far away.
Yeah.
So we only read about it in the magazines, in the New Musical Express.
But it was big news, wasn't it?
It was Tony Blackburn.
Oh, and Tony Blackburn was... He started on Caroline. I think he moved to Radio London, didn't he? But he was almost... He became Radio 1, the BBC, when they legalised. He's like the most famous DJ in Britain, isn't he?
Yeah.
And he was then, and he still is now. Yeah,
he was a Caroline good guy to begin with. And the reason he moved to Radio London, which was the next ship along, just about half a mile away, was because they bought some new Pam's jingles, American Pam's jingles. Caroline didn't have anything that flash, and he liked the sound of that. He wanted to be a real professional, and so he moved to Radio London. I brought him down to Bristol to sing this song. It was called Don't Get Off That Train.
So he was booked as a singer because he had a record out. Was the song any good?
Not really, no. He made about 8 records in his lifetime, and not one of them would ever have been a hit. But did you book him
because you were more interested in the pirate radio side of things then?
Exactly.
Right.
But I told Chris that, you know.
Right.
I said, I want to meet this guy. I want to know how I get on pirate radio. So we booked Tony. He came down, and during the day, he told me who to get in touch with. So Tony Blackburn really started my radio career, because until then, I'd only been a club or a ballroom DJ and a TV DJ. Now I'm being interviewed by the boss of Radio Caroline, and I got the job. Yeah. Because they were impressed that they were getting a guy who was coming from television, whereas most radio DJs go to television.
In fact, radio DJs who then go up on stage and make records, or what? You've done it both ways. You've done it the other way. You were a singer, then a DJ.
Yeah.
And you were a TV star and then a radio star.
But you know, the left turn I made to become a DJ rather than stay as a singer with the band, with the musician union forcing that decision, has always been in the back of my mind. I wonder what. Because just shortly after that, the Beatles broke.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I introduced the Beatles on stage the night Please Please Me went to number one.
Right.
That was in the old. That was in the Oldham top rank.
Yeah.
So you're talking there about 63, 64. And, the A&R men from the record labels came in cavalcades up to Lancashire to try and find more Beatles.
Right, get the next
more Jerry and the Pagans, more Billy J. Kramers, more Searchers, more FOMOs.
Yeah.
I was just sitting there with the Jasons ready for this to happen, and we broke up.
Yeah.
It was such a thing. So I always wondered, you know, would I have made it?
I think things turned out all right, so.
Oh, they did. I'm not knocking it. But it's always in the back of your mind. Because, you know, my first love was singing and doing live stuff with an audience. And throughout my life, any opportunity to take a microphone over with the band, I'm there, you know. I don't do it so much anymore. But I used to love singing, especially singing some rock and roll, you know.
Tell me about Caroline then. So you're living on a ship?
Yeah.
Yeah, that was your life. What was it, 1 week on?
No, it was 2 weeks on.
2 weeks on?
One week off.
What did you do when you weren't on the air?
Oh my God, you can't believe how many letters we got from the fans. I mean, it was sack loads each.
You're 3 miles out. And you were originally on the southern one, which is off the Kent coast.
Yeah, exactly.
And then you moved to the northern one, which is in the Irish Sea.
Yeah, after about 8 weeks on the south ship, I think Ronan O'Reilly, the owner and founder, was listening to his radio, and he said to Chris, the program director, he said, what's he saying? He said, where's he from? He said, he's from Oldham. He said, send him up north. So my accent got me moved, rather than my style, you know.
Yeah. But the Americans, their only image, I suppose, of pirate radio ships is the movie
The boat that rocked.
I think it was called Pirate Radio in America.
Indeed.
I'm guessing it wasn't like that at all.
No, that was a comedy, you know. There was certainly an incident where we climbed up the mast. Mm-hmm. Tony Blackburn and I were the prime people to do that because there was a cable right at the top of the mast that had come loose in the storm. And it was short-circuiting us from broadcasting, and we'd gone 2 days without being on air. And the DJs, we were all frustrated. So we went to the captain and said, we'll climb up this mast. Because the engineers couldn't get out alongside, the tender couldn't get alongside to get the engineers on board. So we were all stuck out there without a signal. So we all had goes, you know, we all went up to different levels. Blackburn eventually went all the way. He was very brave because I noticed I tried before him and I got past the halfway mark. Now, at the halfway mark, that's where Ronan O'Reilly and his people in Ireland welded on the new mast.
Well, to make it taller?
To make it go up to 180 feet. You know, the ordinary mast he had was about 100, then the other 80 feet was this new mast. But the problem was the rungs were bigger than the ones underneath. Mm-hmm. And the safety clip you had a belt and a safety clip that you'd move on each rung as you moved up in case you fell.
Yeah.
It wouldn't clip over these higher rungs. But Blackburn went all the way to the top, and I've always admired him, you know. I've always told people what a hero he was that day. Then the cable came 3/4 the way down, and I went up and relieved that. So it was quite an adventure. And yeah, what did you do on your when you weren't on air? I was just going to answer that, wasn't I? You'd write to your fans,
right?
And you'd build up your fans, your fan base.
It was all letters back then.
Send them. Well, it was more photographs, you know, and sign the back of the photograph. Send them a cryptic message. And of course they loved that, and you'd do dedications, you'd decide which letters got on air for a dedication, and you'd prepare your program. You know, in those early days, we didn't have a severe playlist. We could play pretty well what we wanted, you know. It was wonderful. And then another guy became a part of Caroline, a guy called Phil Solomon, who Ronan needed some money, so Solomon came in as an investor, and he had a label, and he forced his records on us. And the Emperor Roscoe is a great mate of mine, lives in L.A. now. The Emperor Roscoe coming at you here. He threw the records over the side of the ship, you know. he got sacked 3 times. Ronan O'Reilly kept putting him back on air because he's too big a chip to sack. You know what I mean? Roscoe was very popular. And I actually inherited the love for his rhyming and the fact that he'd called himself the Emperor Roscoe.
Yeah.
I was Tony Prince, and I became the Royal Regal Rockin' Ruler.
Right.
Up on the North Ship. So you had the Emperor down on the South Ship, and you had the Royal Ruler on the North Ship. And other things. In the summer, you'd swim. You'd dive off the ship. You'd swim over to the tourist boats, climb on their boat, chat with them, swim back to the ship.
So as long as the weather was okay, it wasn't a bad life then.
It was pretty rough in the winter, to be quite honest. You know, those storms were pretty severe, you know. There used to be a program called the Midnight Surf Party. I was on that one night, and it was a force 12. And every time the ship moved from side to side, the stylus would lift off the record. You see, you don't think about these things that we had to endure, you know. And the rule was, once that happened, you had to cut to a tape recorder, and the tape was on the tape recorder in a bank of tapes on the side of the wall across the other side of the studio, and you had a remote button to play the tape. So I've cut to the tape, and and the record's played, and it comes to an end, and I stop it. You know, you've got this little gap before the next record starts. You'd introduce that, you'd explain to the listeners how bad this storm is and how you've got your knees under your chin holding yourself up. Oh, it's really rough out here tonight, folks. And then suddenly the ship went to 50 degrees. And the tape recorder against the wall came over and staggered and fell on the floor. So now I've no records, I've no tape recorder, all the record rack fell on top of me. And I wish somebody had a recording of it, because all you could hear was me screaming. And then I managed to clamber to my feet, and I said, I'm sorry, folks, but we've got to go off air now. We're in a bad storm. And that was the end of the broadcast.
And that was the end of it. But it wasn't the weather that brought it to the end. It was the government, wasn't it? Which seemed just a bit mean-spirited to me. If all the kids were liking it, the BBC weren't playing the music anyway.
That's right.
What do you think was behind all that then?
Well, I think they didn't have any control.
Right.
They cited that we were giving problems with frequencies for aeroplanes and whatever, communication systems, which was nonsense, you know. But there was a bit of a moody situation. We had not just ships, we had the forts in the Thames estuary,
yeah,
which were forts that were built to fend off the Germans if they came that way, which they never did. But they were wonderful structures, and some of those, like a guy called Screaming Lord Sutch started one.
Yeah,
you know,
the Monster Raving Loony.
Radio City was one, and that's where the problem came. There was a colonel or something and another guy, and they fell out, and one was shot.
Right.
And that was very, very bad publicity for the pirate radio scene.
Yeah,
I think it heralded a quicker end. And what they did, how they stopped the pirate radio ships was simple. They made a law, because they couldn't do anything. They were 3 miles outside the limit, you know.
Yeah.
They couldn't stop them from broadcasting. What they did, they stopped the British subjects from broadcasting. If you're British, you can't broadcast on those ships. And if you're a British company, you can't advertise with them.
Right.
And that was the killer, because that cut off the income stream. One ship continued, Caroline South, everybody else came ashore. And to compensate, the government forced the BBC to start a youth channel, which they called Radio One.
Yeah, the irony is, I mean, the ships were the beginning of commercial radio in this country. You would think it would then kick on and breed commercial radio, which eventually happened. But what it actually did, it invented more BBC radio, didn't it? That was the irony of it. The enemy kind of won.
Well, you know what?
And they were the real pirate, because Radio 1 was a pirate of the pirates, wasn't it? It sounded just like
them. How can people compete with the BBC?
Yeah.
How can commercial radio and commercial television compete with a company who've got floods of money, you know,
who
don't have to sit before a board and explain the profit and loss situation this year, because they never have losses, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, you can't imagine how much the BBC's catalogue is worth in exploiting it around the world. If they were commercial, they'd make even more money.
Yeah, yeah.
But a friend of mine is Richard Park, who runs Global Radio over here. That's probably the most powerful position in radio right now. And he berates them as well. He said they pay a million. Look, Chris Evans, the breakfast show DJ at the moment, gets £2.2 million. £2.2 million, which is about, what, $2.5 million?
Probably a bit more. Over $3 million.
That's his salary, right?
Yeah.
And Richard Park says, how can I compete with that? I can't pay a breakfast show DJ that kind of money, you know?
Yeah.
And that's the problem, really. Which remind me before the end of this interview to tell you about my plans for a new radio channel.
Okay, we'll make sure we get to that. All right, so Marine Offences Act, you come ashore, then you end up at Radio Luxembourg. Just give us a brief description of what Radio Luxembourg was.
Well, in the 30s, 40s, and 50s, it was like the only way people could get light entertainment. It had variety shows and Dan Dare adventures and goodness knows what.
And it broadcast from the Duchy of Luxembourg, but it broadcast at night in English.
Yes, it used the frequencies available to the country of Luxembourg. And some businessmen formed a company called RTL, Radio Tele Luxembourg. They had a German service, a French service, a Dutch service, and the little English service. We were the poor relation, really. But as a poor relation, we'd come on the air at 7:30 at night till 3 in the morning. And it was on the medium wave, AM.
Terrible signal.
Lots of static. But my God, did we love it. Because there was nothing else. And, you know, you've got Elvis coming through and all that great rock and roll. And then you've got the Beatles coming through and all the great groups of the 60s. And you'd put up with the static because there was nothing else until the pirates came along. So Radio Luxembourg as a commercial entity was very successful. They had FM channels for the Germans, FM for the French, but not for us, the English service. It was on shortwave for a little while, but it was mainly on at night on the medium wave and made an absolute fortune for them. I mean, the advertising was coming out of their ears, you know. And the first DJ generation was born on that radio station. None of them who set out to be DJs. Every one of them actors out of work who were offered a job as a DJ by their agent.
Pete Murray, yeah.
Pete Murray, Alan Freeman, David Jacobs. We won't mention Jimmy Savile, but he became very, very big because of his lunatic style. But the general DJs were big bands. You know, Jack Jackson, he was a big band leader. Sam Costa, another actor out of work. But they were what we had. And they read scripts. We didn't know they were reading scripts, though. They just introduced the records we wanted to hear. And the other thing is, they were introducing records. We didn't realize that the record companies themselves were choosing their own records. You'd have the EMI show.
Right.
You know, and the EMI show would only have their records in it, and you'd get the muck as well as the good stuff, you know.
You did.
Yeah. But we didn't know, and we didn't care. We didn't know that was going on. We just, oh, it wasn't a great record, but then here comes a good one, you know. So that was Radio Luxembourg at night. And then the Pirates came along, and people said, well, why didn't the Pirates kill Radio Luxembourg? Well, what it actually did, the Pirates, it made Radio Luxembourg more successful, because what the pirate radio stations did, they made the advertising agencies think more about radio advertising, whereas before there'd only been Radio Luxembourg trying to sell radio advertising. Mm-hmm. The BBC's not commercial.
Yeah.
So you can see what happened there. At the end of the pirate period, Radio Luxembourg went into its biggest economic period.
Because the advertisers knew that the radio advertising worked. It got to the kids.
Correct.
And they baby knew, boomers.
And they knew Radio Luxembourg. At that time, I would say, globally, all over Europe and Britain, had 100 million listeners. It's hard to believe that.
100 million.
I mean, in the United Kingdom, it used to Gallup research at 30 million.
Yeah.
Over the week.
TV shows didn't get that.
But, you know, the reason we knew that we were listened to in those countries was mail we received. And we DJs did gigs. We'd go to clubs. All of this where we made our money. You know, the radio station paid us a good salary. But 2 days off, we'd be on a plane to England, Scandinavia, Spain, everywhere. You know, it was just an incredible thing to be a Radio Luxembourg DJ because we were so popular in places. I mean, the BBC Radio 1 DJs only had the United Kingdom.
Yeah.
Radio Luxembourg DJs had Europe.
You were on a panel a few years ago at an event, a Radio Academy event, and it was celebrating Radio Luxembourg. And who was there? I think Pete Murray was there, and I think...
Paul Burnett
was definitely there.
You had Mike Reed,
and you,
Sean Tilley.
You mentioned on that... from that panel that you had not long ago had found a recording that you did of an interview with Ringo Starr. I think it was at the George Sank Hotel in Paris. But you had no memory of recording it. How much does it worry you that as you get into your senior years that some of your wonderful memories might leave you?
Well, you know what? The internet's changed that. Everything I ever did is out there.
It's on there now.
So, you know, the Ringo Starr interview was amazing because he was drunk as a lord.
Oh, was
I was probably a bit drunk myself, and we had a go.
Well, maybe that's why.
We had a lot of fun, you know. And some photos turned up as well, a little strip of photos where I'm actually talking to him. So it's lovely unearthing things like that, you know. I've also got stuff in my library, you know, which I'll show you before you leave.
Lovely, yeah.
I've got some old tapes there and that, which might surface even now.
Excellent. And you did hang out, you mentioned earlier, parties and that.
I'm not sure.
Alexa, shut down! I'll smash your face in.
The 21st century catches up with us. You met a lot of the big music stars from back then, and you were big mates with Keith Moon.
Yeah.
Was he as wild as...
Of course he was.
Was he?
Of course he was.
So that isn't made up. He really was crackers.
He was just great, you know. We'd go to the same clubs together and get drunk together and, you know, we'd go out on a boat on the Thames with Elton John and he'd just like, you know, he couldn't wait to go on the toilet, so I had to hold his hands while I had to poo over the side. you can't make it up, you know. Oh my God, I did party with Led Zeppelin in Scotland, and the things that they were doing are just, well, I put them in my, I've got a book out, you know that,
yeah,
don't you?
Yeah.
The Royal Ruler and the Railway DJ, and I recount some of those stories, you know.
How many Buddy Holly events did you host for Paul McCartney?
About 10 years.
Yeah.
What happened there was Paul bought Buddy Holly's songbook. He got the publishing rights.
He was a big fan too.
He was a big, big fan. He was a bigger fan of Buddy Holly than Elvis.
Because mm-hmm. the writing.
If you asked him, he just liked his music and his songs more than... I mean, you know, you could never knock Elvis's songs. They were Lieber and Stoller classics, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
But he just had a thing about Buddy Holly. And of course, he also had a conscience, you know, and he knew how he would want to be treated if somebody bought his songs. So every year he had a Buddy Holly week. Him and Linda staged something or other. It could be a concert, could be a t-shirt design. Okay. And then one year he brought in Norman Petty and Vi, his wife, from Lubbock.
But he's a producer. He produced all those great,
Correct.
Yeah.
And I've got an amazing photograph of that gathering with in a venue in London, in a garden. And you've got in the photograph, you've got Elton John, Queen, Eric Clapton, Paul and Linda McCartney, 10cc. Oh my God, I'll show it you afterwards. It's a massive photo of all Paul and Linda's guests to welcome Norman Petty to London.
Wow.
It's just an
they
amazing...
all wanted to meet him, yeah.
Of course they did. Yeah. But and also there are very few people who would turn Paul McCartney invite down, you know.
Exactly.
I mean, the other thing they did was Linda persuaded the Hard Rock on Piccadilly to introduce a veggie burger to their menu.
Brilliant.
They'd never had a veggie burger before Linda McCartney moved in.
She turned you veggie, didn't she?
She did, yeah.
Are you still veggie?
I am, yes.
And that's all thanks to Linda?
It is, yeah. Yeah.
Just amazing.
So I'd have been dead years ago with all that cholesterol, you know. I had a heart attack and everything, but yeah, I've survived. But the Linda McCartney night at the Hard Rock, they had a launch party there. It was just absolutely amazing. So Priscilla Presley showed up for that one.
Did she really?
Yeah.
So by the early 80s, you're the program director at Luxembourg, and that's when I started listening to Radio Luxembourg, so I was at the very, very end of it. About 81, I passed my driving test, so I had my little Ford Escort, and it was like I was driving around at night with my mates, and they're like, what are you listening to this for? I'm like, no, there was something, and I learned later, you know, getting into radio, that it was just the way that Luxembourg was put together. It was just put together like a proper commercial
radio
station.
It was, and it was fast-moving.
Radio 1 wasn't like that. It was
fast-moving. It was driving force, high-powered jingles, Bob Stewart's deep voice, you know.
Power play.
Broadcasting on 208 meters in the medium wave, 1440 kilohertz AM, with a power of 1.3 million watts. This is the English service of Radio Luxembourg. Our programs commence in just a moment, and they'll continue until 3 a.m. in the United Kingdom. We hope you'll stay with us, because Radio Luxembourg rocks Great Britain, Great Britain, Great Britain, Great Britain.
The best sound you've ever heard. Radio Luxembourg.
Who was the American guy, the Cosmic Cowboy?
Well, it was Bob Stewart. People thought he was American, but he was a Liverpudlian. Really.
Oh, was he really?
Yeah, and he fell in love with American movies and started talking like
a
Yank, yeah.
Wow.
No.
And he had the Marlborough Country Music Show, music with a flavour
all
its own.
Yeah, he did, Country and Western. He was our big country DJ as well. And you know what, Bob, when he auditioned for Radio Caroline, he was asked to phone Chris Moore, the programme director in London. So he did, he phoned Chris Moore, and he had the real Bob Stewart here. Hi, Chris, how are you? You know, man. And he immediately knew he was going to employ Bob Stewart. How could you not? He said, you know, we only pay people here £25 a week. I don't know what's that in dollars? Bob, he said, I don't know, I'm from Liverpool.
Rob Jones was from Liverpool too, wasn't he? And he was on there at the time, yeah.
Yeah, I employed Rob.
And the wonderful Stuart Henry. Hello, my friend.
Yeah.
He was just...
Now, there's a radio story for you.
Yeah.
The BBC fired him because they thought he was a bit high every day going into the broadcasting house with a sailor's gait as he walked across broadcasting house. He got fired. I employed him at Radio Luxembourg. And it got worse. He had multiple sclerosis. We sent him off to Germany to see specialists. RTL paid for all that for him. And they analysed him to have multiple sclerosis. So he got worse. His voice started to slur his words, all because of this disease. And I started getting letters from the listeners thinking he was drunk, you know. And I knew he wasn't.
Mm.
So I called him over to London with his wife, Holly. Alan Keane, my boss, and I sat him in Wheeler's Fish Restaurant across the road and said, Stuart, we've got to stop people thinking you're drunk. There's only one way to do it. You've got to come out of the closet. You've got to tell the world you've got MS, and you've got to start a charity foundation. Mm. And once you do that, instead of them thinking you're a lush, will think you're a hero, which you are, actually.
Yeah.
So he went along with it, and we started the Stuart Henry Multiple Sclerosis Appeal, put out the campaign on air, and it just gave him longevity to his career.
But it was one of the things I liked about it, because he was so open on the air about it. And
Ollie was his wife. She started reading the news for him because he couldn't do a whole news bulletin. And then he became a bit of a double act, you know.
He was just so genuine.
He was a wonderful, wonderful DJ and person. And I don't think anybody in America would ever envisage a radio station maintaining somebody who's slurring their speech. Yeah. They wouldn't do it. They just would not do it.
Yeah.
But he was such a legend, people put up with it.
Yeah. It was wonderful. I know I was there at the very end of Luxembourg, but it was very important to me. And there's something about nighttime radio. I worked on the radio at nighttime in Australia, and it is a very, very different thing. It's much more intimate.
Very intimate. That's the word. Definitely intimate. Because if people are searching you out at night, you know, it's more likely they're on their own or in a car driving somewhere.
I used to get Vietnam veterans ringing up for certain songs that took them back to talk about mates they'd lost and everything.
Yeah.
And we were strangers, but they were opening up to me about that. It's a very, and I really do envy. I remember when I got into radio, I worked at a station. The first station I worked at was in the outback, a place called Parks in the central western New South Wales. I was doing the breakfast show there. It was my first radio job. And I was telling my wife all about, she's in New Zealand, I'd met her in New Zealand. I was telling her all about Radio Luxembourg and how great it was. I said, why don't I just ring them up and tell them that, you know. So I rang up and someone on the other end of the phone said, it's finished. And I don't know where I got this number from, but I was ringing and I sat down and it was almost like I'd lost someone.
Yeah, yeah. I'd and lost. You were so far away, you didn't even realise what had happened.
I'd missed it. It was like a friend had gone. Yeah. That's how important Luxembourg was,
man,
to people.
On Facebook, I'm still inundated with people who miss it, you know, who love it, said it's never been the same since. But we're going to change that.
Okay, well, we'll get to that in a bit. Why did you leave Radio Luxembourg?
I left Radio Luxembourg because Alan Keane left. He got knocked off the board, and I inherited a new hierarchy of directors. And I didn't like the way their policy was directing. They were more interested in going to the satellite with television than securing the future for the English service of Radio Luxembourg. And in the end, I just couldn't work with those people. And they shook my hand, gave me a good package, and off I went. But to be quite honest, I wouldn't have just left like that. I had something up my sleeve. About a year earlier, I used to get cassettes from people who wanted a job on the station, like you. If you were going to get a job on Luxembourg, you'd record a cassette show and send it to me. I would listen to all those cassettes because I was once a cassette. I knew what it was like, hoping that they would listen and like. So I did listen religiously. And in most cases, I'd listen in the car going home because there was a cassette player there. And you only have to listen to a couple of links and you knew whether it was good or bad. And so that was what I used to do regularly. And one day I got a tape and there was no voice on it. It was just music. So I put it on the corner of my desk, and must have been 2 months went by, and I saw it still there gathering dust. And I thought, I'll listen to it going home tonight. So I put it in the car. I'm driving down the M4 motorway and I suddenly get it. The guy's mixing records in beat, in key, non-stop mixes. It's just wonderful. I suppose it was the musician in me that made me appreciate how clever, you know, beat mixing was. But there was no such thing in clubs in those days in Britain. So I invited the kid in. He was a kid called Alan Coulthard. He lived in Wales. And I brought him down to Radio Luxembourg every week to do a mix. And these mixes became so popular I had a dance music program at the time. And I started the Disco Mix Express. And DJs started writing to me from clubs. How do we get these mixes? Because all they heard was a great mix with static all over it.
Right.
So they couldn't even bootleg it, you know. So that's when I got the idea. I went to see Morris Oberstein, one of the world's great American record industry men. He was the chairman of the BPI, the big cheese. He was boss of Sony. And we went out for lunch together to the White Elephant on Curzon Street, which we did regularly. And then I gave it to him. I said, I've got an idea, Morris, that can change your promotional ideas in all the record companies. What I need is for you to give me permission to mix your catalogue into medleys. On the back of that, we can send out these mixes and then do another I said cassette in those days, it eventually became records. Yeah. We can send previews of tracks you've got coming out. At the moment, you employ people to send 12-inch records to all these DJs in clubs. If we send them one LP with the hottest records, but only 3 minutes, they'll go out and buy the 12-inch. But they will love that other product. The mixes are what they want. We're calling them mega mixes. So he took me to the BPI committee, my wife came with me, I've got my world ahead of me, my life in my hands, and I pitch all these executives from all the major labels round a boardroom table. And blow me down, they gave me permission, I got a license, the first in the world, to dub their product. And that was how the Disco Mix Club began, which became DMC. Within a year, we had 4,000 members all over Britain and Europe. It was a phenomenon. And then we introduced the World DJ Championships, which involves live mixing with vinyl on two turntables, the birth of the Technics turntable. That's still going today. We have a great branch in New York, and they put on World Championships in about 20 states every year and bring their American champion to London for the World Final. And we have them coming from Australia, New Zealand, everywhere. Everywhere, it's wonderful. So that's kind of like a legacy from me to the world, the DJ championships, and the quantum leap from talking in a microphone in a nightclub, which they used to putting that microphone down and getting into production work, mixing music together in a very creative way, which led to remixing, which led to the DJs, the Guettas of this world today, who are producing music and working with major artists.
Even Elvis.
Every one of them.
Elvis had a hit record.
Exactly. That was a DJ.
Ago.
That was a DJ mix, you know.
Yeah, a little less.
So we've started something. I think people will bear testament that it was DMC that inspired the world to do that. So there you go. That's my legacy.
And talking of legacies, you've got the book.
Yeah, I tell you what happened. As I told you, I did a lot of gigs in Europe, and I was invited to go to Czechoslovakia. Nobody had ever been before.
Behind the Iron Curtain back then.
Behind the Iron Curtain, the Russians had invaded, and how I got in there, I don't know. I do now. But this agency had a fan of Radio Luxembourg in it, and he very quickly invited me over. He told me, look, we can pay you money, but you can't spend it outside of Czechoslovakia. I said, I don't care. I want to come and see you guys. So I gets in my Jag, takes the wife, and we drive over Germany into Czechoslovakia. And I do 3 gigs. And at the second one, it was a place called Brno. I did Prague as well, and another place called Karlovy Vary. But in Brno, I met a guy called Jan Sestak, a great DJ and the owner of the club. We had a wonderful, wonderful gig. Now, 30 years later, I've been living in America in Manhattan, and I've come back to live in England, and suddenly got a call from Jan Sestak, the DJ. He said, Tony, it's 30 years since you were here. The club's still here. Will you come and have a reunion with us? So I jumps on a plane, and I goes and has this reunion. And in the course of the evening, I mean, you know, all those kids who came 30 years earlier, they're 50, 60 now, you know. We had a wonderful night. But afterwards, with the owner and a couple of DJs and Jan, we start talking about what they endured in that period when I went last time. Because once I came out, the only other artists who had ever performed there were Paul Anka and Manfred Mann, Western American.
Because they couldn't even buy the records, could they?
There was no record shops.
Yeah.
There was no tape recorders. Jan Sestak became the lyricist for all the groups in and around Brno. This meant if the Beatles' Hard Day's Night just come out, he has to listen to Luxembourg as many times as he can to get every word so they can do cover versions and sing the English lyrics.
It's the only way.
It's no tape recorder. Yeah. How do you write down every word? I mean, the minute the song's finished, he's got to wait God knows how long before he hears
it
again.
And English not your first language as well.
Exactly. Yeah, although I've got to say, Radio Luxembourg inspired a lot of Europeans to learn English because of the DJs, because of the lyrics in the song. And Jan was a prime example of that.
There's probably people in Europe with older accents.
No, there's people in Europe got static in their voices when they speak English. So that inspired me. I said, Jan, listen, I've heard your stories. I think there's a hell of a book here. I'm just about to write. I started in America when I was living in Battery Park City, and I had nothing to do at night. I could go out and get drunk every night, but I decided to write my story. I said, I'm well on the way with that. I'd like to now embrace your stories. So he then started sending me these anecdotes, these different stories of what they all endured, how he became a railway worker, how a committee turned him down. Talk about Musicians Union and me. He had to sit before a committee. What do you want to do, this woman says. He says, I would like to be a DJ. She stands up, walks out the room, said, we don't want any DJs. That was the end of his audition.
Right.
So that was communism for you, you know. But eventually he became a railway DJ in an outback railway. They were putting new tracks down. There was an old railway station there, and they went down the village and they got some wine and they brought all the girls and boys back to, and that was his first gig. That's why he's called the railway DJ, because he used to do gigs in a railway track, and they'd take kids in the train for rides and play the Beatles and Elvis. He had eight records in his collection. He had to play the B-sides. That's all he had, eight records. His story is just, I've said to people, please, I haven't written a book because of a DJ's ego. I've written a historic book. It's the story of teenagers captured by this awful communist regime, the Russian intervention. It had to be told. Nobody's ever told it before. And I want people to read it, so they can understand how bad communism was.
And what freedom is.
And what freedom is, and how these kids managed to get through 40 years before the wall came down and the Iron Curtain melted.
Fantastic. Tony, tell us about this radio channel you're working on then. What's this?
Yeah. You know what? I sometimes wonder why I keep doing these things. You know, I got an idea once to start a TV channel called Wedding TV.
Yeah.
It ran for 5 years. I became program director. I learned how to make TV programs. Now, I can't resist good ideas, you see. This is the problem. I started Nightlife Holidays, which was the start of Ibiza. I used to take DJs and fans on an aeroplane to Ibiza and Mallorca. I just love ideas if I think they've got a commercial entity. And this idea is something that's probably going to be the last thing I ever do. I'm starting a new channel online. I'm ignoring FM because I think FM is dead. Mm-hmm. I don't think it's got any future. I think the internet is the place to be. I think the streaming potential to get internet into cars is now here. And you can now listen to the car radio. You can listen to the tablet, the computer, the telephone, and you can follow your radio station anywhere in the world you want to do. Now, what's been happening in the United Kingdom with these great legendary DJs who you know, you've mentioned some of them, they've been built up by the BBC and then they've been thrown off the roof of Broadcasting House with no safety net. That's the end of their career as far as the BBC are concerned. They've built them up to be stars in Great Britain and then fired them and brought the next team in. So they're all my mates and they're all frustrated. And I've got all these people on Facebook saying, God, I wish they were all back on air. So I'm bringing them all back on air. I've got about 20 DJs so far who are well known in the United Kingdom.
Can you give us any names?
I can. I can give you Neil Fox. I can give you Mike Reed. I can give you Timmy Mallett, Paul Burnett, Mark Wesley, Tony Prince. We're all going to be doing shows. I don't want to miss anyone out, but there are quite a lot, some that the people in America will not know of. And it will take them back to the old days of this radio you were talking about, how different it was, why you stayed tuned to Luxembourg, because it's a driving force, it's speedy, it's exciting, and the jingles and the DJs are all united on bringing excitement to the airwaves, and that's what we're going to do. And I'm so damned excited, I can't begin to tell you. It's called Deluxe Radio, D-LUX. That's in tribute to Radio Luxembourg and the spirit of Radio Luxembourg. But it's got nothing to do with Radio Luxembourg and a hell of a lot to do with the DJs who are on Radio Luxembourg, who are going to revive 45, revive 45.
Tony, where can we find out more about you?
Well, I'm on Facebook. What do you want to find out?
Have you got a website?
DMCworld.com.
DMCworld.com.
That's my company, but I'm not really on there very much. That's about DJs and the World DJ Championships.
If we want the book, it's on Amazon.
You can get it from Amazon or you can get it from DMC World. There's a store there that sells it. And we do actually deliver around the world. hopefully, you know, a publisher will come out of the woodwork in America one day and get it released over there. I'm also, somebody in California is interested in trying to make a film out of it. I think that's a wonderful idea, you know, these kids.
It sounds like a film.
Not particularly my story, you know, but, you know, coming from me on Radio Luxembourg and all this excitement going on, then going over the Iron Curtain and seeing what's going on there, that would make a hell of a film.
Who'd play Tony Prince?
I don't know. Brad Pitt's a bit old now, isn't he? But, Jan Sestak and his friends deserve their story to be told. And as he was a railway DJ, I've even got the ending. It's not this in the book. But for the film, I think he's going to switch the track, steal a train, and take all his mates to the West for freedom. That'll be the end of the film.
That's a film. That's a Hollywood ending right there,
exactly.
Isn't it?
Exactly. So is anybody listening to this in Hollywood, get in touch.
Tony Prince, the royal ruler, long may you reign.
Oh, thank you so much.
Thank you, Tony.
I'm hoarse now. I've never talked that much since Radio Luxembourg. Thank you very much.
Well, that's it for this one. I hope you can join me for the next one. In the meantime, you can follow me on Twitter. I'm at Graham Mac. If you want to hear more Mac Nuggets, check out my website, macmedia.co.uk, and subscribe to my Bob FM show on Apple Podcasts. Got a question or something to say? Send me an email. Put your phone number in the email. I might call you back or even Skype you on the show. My email address is graham@macmedia.co.uk, and you spell Graham like the cracker, Mac like the truck. Till next time, ta-da.